From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a thirsty land, the history of drought, the rule of capture, and the future of water in Texas. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. They tell you in Texas, don't curse those rainy days because you never know when the rain will stop and stop and stop. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, over half of Texas is in drought and 20% is in extreme drought. That's mainly in the upper panhandle. There have been long stretches when the rain didn't come to Texas. And drought, like the big one in the 1950s, the drought of record, can be devastating. The Texas Drought of Record was a period between 1949 and 1957 in which the state received 30 to 50% less rainfall than normal, the worst years being 1951, 54, and 56. As a result, the number of Texas farms and ranches shrank from 345,000 to 247,000. The income of Texas farmers fell by 20%, and crop yields in some areas were cut in half. Some Texas towns went completely dry, and they had to have all of their water trucked in. Since then, Texas has gone through a lot of changes. It's a lot more urban, and there are a lot more Texans. In 1955, Texas had a population of 8.6 million people. Today, the population is 28.7 million. It's expected that the population in Texas will hit 54.5 million by 2050. Will there be enough water? If Texas sees another drought of record or worse, what would that look like? How is the state prepared for that possibility? And with the development of global warming, the chances of a long and devastating drought is more likely. Seamus McCraw writes about this in his new book, A Thirsty Land, The Making of an American Water Crisis.
There is very little question, and certainly the state takes this position, that there simply is not the ability right now to turn around and survive with sufficient water another drought of record. And the truth is that the drought of record, while it may be unique in the lifetime of people alive today, is not unique in Texas's long, long history. We can expect more droughts like that. We can expect the kind of flooding we saw in this past year as a result of increasingly severe storms. We can expect deeper droughts. We can expect more furious storms. And the state of Texas is not, at the moment, prepared for that. That seems to be the consensus among pretty much everybody who studies this sort of thing. The last drought, Texas dodged a bullet. It is a mark of, I think, the confidence of a lot of people involved that one town came close, but no town ran out of water in that last drought. But that is not likely to be the case going forward. There's a real challenge. And by the way, the challenge is not for Texas alone. One of the things that kind of drove me to do this book is that Texas, if Texas is unique in any way, it's that every possible manifestation of the looming water issues that we see across the United States are represented within the empire of Texas. And every possible obstacle to addressing those are as well. So it behooves the rest of the nation to kind of watch Texas and see how Texas finds its way forward in this. And it's a fascinating story watching them do it.
A coworker goes on an annual canoeing trip every year, and he goes down the Llano River, and he just left for the trip this week, and he's saying that there's less water in the river now than ever before. He's been doing this trip for 20 years. They're going to be carrying that canoe more than it carries them. People don't realize that right now Texas is in a drought presently.
Absolutely. And it's not just Texas. I mean, at this very moment, or at least as of a few days ago, 13 miles of the Rio Grande in New Mexico are dry. And that was in April and in May. The snowpack in the southern Rockies has been spectacularly low this year. Yes, a good portion of the state is in drought. This is an urgent, looming issue, and it has profound impacts again on basically every sector of the society in Texas.
So, the crisis of supply, those are the words that people don't like to hear or even think about. What would happen if there was a crisis of supply of water for communities in Texas?
Well, it depends on the community. In some communities, you know, you would see the first thing that you would see, I think, would be the imposition of very stringent water management regimens. I think you would see a real crackdown. But the other thing is, look, there's another word we don't like to use when we talk about water, and that word is commodity. We don't like to think of water the way we think of other commodities, but it is one. It is one that has a moral component, absolutely. I mean, it is to some degree the essence of life, and therefore it needs to be available. But at the same time, if you saw the kind of crisis that I think people are anticipating and really fearing, I think you would see, among other things, the price of water becoming very, 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 very dear.
Well, dear for who? Dear for the...
dear for those who could afford it, quite frankly.
I mean, for the farmers?
Yeah, here's the thing. I mean, yes, to some degree you would have it for the farmers. There's the story that I tell about the rice farmers along the lower Colorado, who were to a very great extent instrumental in developing the very system on which the LCRA depends. They were instrumental, quite frankly, in pushing for the reservoirs that allowed for the growth of Austin and allowed for the growth of the recreational industry in the Hill Country. And when push came to shove in that last drought, those guys who were instrumental in the creation of this, because so much growth had occurred upriver, found themselves cut off from water. So yes, it would be dear for them, but not just for them. Not just for them. It would be dear for people in places like Dallas and Fort Worth. It would be dear for people in Austin. It would be dear for people in Fort Stockton. It would be dear for people everywhere. And already, you're seeing the commoditization of water. When you turn around and look at, there's a story that I tell in the book about, for a variety of reasons, many of them having nothing to do with water, why the sort of agricultural community around Presidio has dried up to a very great extent. And that left one farmer with very little option but to sell his water. You know, when it becomes a commodity, it drives an economics unto itself. We can avert those kinds of crises. And I think to some degree, again, the state does deserve some credit for having narrowly averted it the last time. But I think we need to recognize that the climate is changing. The culture is changing. The demands on water are changing. And I think we need to recognize that it's incumbent on all of us to begin to kind of break down those barriers between urban and rural, between suburban and urban, between industry and agriculture, between environmentalists and industry, and begin to find a way forward. And I think there are some voices out there who are starting to turn around and point in that direction.
So they say, look upstream at our problems. How did we get here? And there are many streams that we have to look up to figure out the situation. One of them is climate change, where we have a warming planet and water is going to get more scarce and then it's going to become more plentiful. We have this great weather variation issue that we're going to be dealing with. And also we have the convoluted Texas water law that seems to be based upon power and money.
Well, it's based on power to some degree. It's based on money to some degree. It's based on tradition to some degree. But beyond all of that, David, you know what I think it comes down to? I think it comes down to culture. And again, when I talk about Texas being emblematic of much of the rest of the country, and water as being a debate which is emblematic of so many of the debates that we're having, the one peculiarity about Texas water law, of course, in terms of Western states, is the rule of capture. The idea that whatever lies beneath a man's land and whatever lies above it is his is to infinity. That's a question of individual rights. And one of the things that it's unique in the West. Most other Western states have either dramatically curtailed the rule of capture or abandoned it altogether. It is still prevalent in the East, where, of course, there's plenty of water. But what that really is it's almost an icon of the kind of debates we're having in this country right now about so many things, about the individual rights, the rights of an individual, and how do we balance those against the needs of a, quite frankly, fast-growing community. And we're having that debate. That debate affects most of the major issues in the culture. It's the same root debate. It's just that it's played out in very stark relief in Texas.
Right. You say it's culture, but culture is a reflection of the reality that we will recognize. And so you tell the story in your book, A Thirsty Land, The Making of an American Water Crisis, of the original case law that gave us the rule of capture, which was the Denison Railroad Station.
Well, in that situation, you had the railroad company that basically turned around and pumped all the water out from underneath a gentleman's land. He took him to court, and frankly, he lost. The bottom line was that the court ruled in 1901 that groundwater was mysterious and occult. So mysterious and occult that it was beyond the ken of the court in those days to turn around and really regulate it. Now, even then, they turned around and suggested that the legislature could do that. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that 2 years later, California saw things very differently and came up with a ruling that said, indeed, no, this is not all that mysterious and occult. There are ways we can regulate it for the common good, and we need to do that. So Texas has been diverging literally for well over a century and continues to. Now, there have been some limits placed on the rule of capture. They may be in jeopardy now with some more recent decisions, but there have been steps taken to do it. But ultimately, the ball is really in the state legislature's court to really decide what is in the best interest of Texas at large. And thus far, they really haven't done a great deal to achieve that.
So the story of the railroad, and they needed a well in order to supply their trains, steam engines with water.
With water, absolutely.
And so they drilled the well, and they started pumping out the water.
The old drink your milkshake thing. They could take, you know, the bottom line on the law, just for those who may be unfamiliar with it, is it really distills down to this: whoever has the biggest pump wins. In Texas, basically the law is that if I drill a well, I can't be responsible for the fact that I may suck all the water out from underneath your adjoining piece of property. And if you want to stop me, your best bet is to get a bigger pump and pump faster than I do. And there's sort of a perverse incentive in that, particularly in a place where that is at least a significant portion of it is arid and tremendously drought-prone in the best of times. That incentive becomes even more perverse when, as you pointed out, we're talking about entering into cycles of climate in which there's very little debate among the people who study such things. The dry places are going to get drier, and the wet places are going to get wetter. And if our current law basically is designed to encourage somebody to take as much as they want, that does not bode well for the future.
So we saw that pattern or that act repeated multiple times, but most colorfully, you tell the story in your book, A Thirsty Land, about how Clayton Williams, a colorful oil man, and many people know him in Texas, and his family and their enterprise in West Texas, and how they pumped out the water from underneath the Comanche Springs.
Comanche Springs, right. They basically turned, and it's a wonderful story. I mean, Clayton Williams' father had come from Massachusetts. He was, I believe, an attorney who was suffering, as his grandson Jeff put it to me, from I guess respiratory problems, and had come out here for his health, and was doing some petroleum geology work. And stumbled across the idea that there's a lot of water to be found in the aquifer under Comanche Springs, enough that that basically became his primary occupation. And by the 1950s, they had drained the legendary Comanche Springs. There is at this time there's a replica of Comanche Springs in the town of Fort Stockton that flows a few months a year. And quite frankly, there was very little that could be done to stop them. And now flash forward a couple of generations, the Williams family is again farming, and they have the ability to pump in excess of 40,000 acre feet. They only use about 20,000. The Williamses wanted to pump it to Odessa and Midland. Some of it, about half of it, to Odessa and Midland, because there was a market for the water, and that they could be prevented from doing. And so it ended up in a lengthy and protracted and occasionally testy court battle. Ultimately, the Williams prevailed, but before they did, Jeff wanted to make a point. Jeff Williams wanted to make a point. And so he turned around and he said, well, you know what? You won't let me ship my water, but you can't stop me from pumping it. So here's what I'm going to do with it. And what he did was he basically did a test plot of rice in Fort Stockton, there at the virtual edge of the Chihuahuan Desert. He made it very clear that he was making a point. But also, David, that story illustrates something else that I think is fascinating, and that is the kind of whack-a-mole nature of trying to deal with water issues and why the parochial approach may not be the best one. It really underscores a point that Representative Lyle Larson makes in the book, and that is the need for kind of this 30,000-foot view, as he puts it. We are either all Texans or we aren't.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies, and I'm speaking with Seamus McGraw. His book is A Thirsty Land, The Making of an American Water Crisis. That kind of depends on which side of the water pipeline you're on. The folks up in Burleson County who are looking at San Antonio's Vista Ridge Pipeline, and they're seeing, as they see it, their water being evacuated to San Antonio and other communities, other major metropolitan areas, looking at other similar schemes, they wonder about their water.
Absolutely, and that's the point in all of this 30,000-foot view. The point is that there has to be some perspective that turns around and gives the appropriate weight to the needs of everybody involved, instead of turning around and looking at it purely from a parochial interest. San Antonio is developing a lot of options. You know, Vista Ridge is certainly one of them. San Antonio is developing many options. And the question is, to what extent can they develop those options and not damage and diminish the communities that they're drawing from? And again, that's not something that can be done on a parochial basis, because then you just end up pitting one community against another. You know, that has to be done, I think, from a more centralized point of view.
At the heart of this is there need to be a recognition that there is a finite supply of water in Texas, and we have more and more people coming here all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have a whole lot of imagination to realize one of these days we're going to have a big problem.
Yes, It doesn't take a great deal of imagination to recognize the fact that you are among the among the fastest growing cities in the country, that have increasing demands, that are placing increasing demands on your right, a water system that, even under the best of circumstances, it's worth remembering that there is not a new drop of water in the world. There is no such thing as new water. And now that the circumstances have changed because of, and we can argue all day long about what it is that sparked this change in climate, but there is a changing climate. The dry places, as I said, are getting drier. The wet places are getting wetter. The people are not necessarily going where the water is. We haven't planned for this. I remain confident that we will eventually rise to the challenge. I'm just not sure we'll rise to it in time.
Well, timing is everything in this issue. You write about the 1968 water plan that Texans had a chance to vote on, and they rejected. And this was a massively ambitious plan involving moving water from the wet parts of the state to the drier parts of the state.
Oh, it was even more than that. It was turning around and basically replumbing the entire state of Texas, moving the Mississippi River, for all intents and purposes, or a significant chunk of it, all the way to Albuquerque, and all the way across the southern part of the state as well. It was kind of the last grand top-down approach. It hailed from a period of time when we believed we could engineer our way out of any problem.
Because this was the era of the moon launch, and we had these mega engineering projects that we thought we could, and that it was just a question of throwing money at these types of problems and moving dirt around. But we didn't do it. Texans narrowly rejected it.
Very narrowly. 1% of the vote.
But that was 50 years ago, and apparently we didn't need all that work.
Well, I'm not sure that's necessarily true. I think it probably would have. It's very difficult to turn around and look back at something like that and say what would have happened if it had been approved and if it had actually been built and if Texas did indeed spend the money. I think you would see a very different Texas today than the Texas that you see. I think if you had turned around and built this series of reservoirs and these plants to turn around and elevate the water, and if you had turned around and watered this, it would have been similar to what happened when the railroads came in, like in the East case, where the infrastructure dictated what the growth of Texas would have been in the years that followed. So I think it's very difficult to turn around and say, well, we would have been better off or worse off had that happened. No, I think Texas would have been radically different. But the question is, do we still have the will to look at something from that perspective, even if we don't any longer have the faith in our ability to engineer our environment to that extent? And I'm not sure that we do. I think that may have been, if you'll pardon the expression, the high watermark in Texas for the idea of a grand Texas-wide vision on this. Maybe to some degree we need to revisit that, but not necessarily in terms of the same kind of, as you put it, bulldozer-intensive development that they were talking about in 1968.
They were coming just out of the drought of record of the 50s, so it was still very fresh in people's minds about how disastrous that was. Now we have so many more people in Texas than we did back then. So if we had a similar intensity of a drought in the state, we would have a crisis of supply.
And here's an important point to remember, too. Many of those people... the drought of record was, it changed one aspect of the character of Texas, and that it did drive a lot of people from the farms and the ranches who never returned and drove them into the towns and drove them into the cities. And that was a significant change. But here's the thing. One of the reasons that I don't think people necessarily recognized how risky the last drought was is that to some degree, they are more insulated from it now than they were then. If you were out in the country in the 1950s and your well dried up, your well dried up. If you're living in San Antonio or Austin or Dallas right now and there's a drought, there's still water coming out of your tap for now. And that's the problem, I think. I think the problem is that it's very difficult for people to recognize the severity of the threat that they're facing when they're insulated from it until they're not, until it becomes a real crisis. And at that point, I think they'll recognize, the Franklin said, you recognize the value of water when your well runs dry?
The legislature has, they've put money into the pot. We have projects that are happening around the state. We're trying to fix municipal water systems so that they don't leak. We're trying to create new resources of water. We're getting better at the science of where's this water coming from and where's it going. Is that going to be too little, too late?
For now, it seems to be sufficient. Those kinds of steps percolating up from the local regions, those kinds of steps have turned around and they did help hedge against the worst consequences in many places of the last drought, which was indeed as deep in some places, if not as long, as the drought of record. The thing is that will they be enough to turn around and survive a drought of record or worse? Nothing is more important when we're discussing the value of water than nothing.
Well, let me challenge you on that. There's nothing. One thing in Texas could be more important than the value of water in the drought, and that's the concept and the culture of Texas when it comes to property rights, and that's what a lot of people are clinging to when they talk about the rule of capture. So in order to deal with that massive cultural point of you cannot take my water from me, this belongs to me, it's really going to have to be a serious situation.
I think it has to be a crisis. I think it does have to be a crisis. I don't think there's any debate about that. Because you are talking about something that comes down to, and this is what I was saying before, it's something that comes down to cultural identity. And it may be cast, as I said, it may be cast in starker relief in Texas. It may be part of the mythic ethos of Texans, but it is not unique to Texas. This is a debate we are having, this idea of my individual rights versus hedging against real risks in the future is something we see fought out on a score of different issues. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's going to take a crisis in order to force the acceptance that action is needed. Yeah, there's the line in the book that's oft repeated in Texas that you need two things in order to accomplish anything in Texas on water, and one is a drought and the other is a budget surplus. I think that's absolutely true. I think there does have to be a loaded gun pointed at people's heads in order for them to turn around and really rise to the challenge.
Seamus McGraw is the author of A Thirsty Land, The Making of an American Water Crisis. It's published by the University of Texas Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can also write on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can hear past Texas Matters programs, and you can download us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.